Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Kiss those lips and say I love you, but chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you. But chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy and Brad Williams? Y'all like Amy and Brad? Brad Williams fronts the Arkansas premier feel-good country band, The Salty Dogs. He and his wife, Amy, have been playing music together for 10 years. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with such blues legends as John Weston and Sam Carr. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? We are thrilled to once again feature these genuine screen doors with mixed media portraiture by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox, which are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories are all about various instances of our writers flying solo. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Randy Romo's mom is gone, and she has to make a quick decision on her own. And we'll end the night with Michael Hilden alone with a wild creature. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Gary Pittman with No One Else in Sight in Bluebird Basketball.
It was the night an out-of-town girlfriend came to see me play as captain of the Bluebirds basketball team. My moment came late in the second half. This was it, my time to shine, my time to prove my masculinity to her and everyone in those stands, hell, everyone in the town. After flashing the lane for a steal, the crowd was cheering and I was wide open for an uncontested layup. That fall, in 1965, a long and rich basketball tradition had descended to my shoulders as captain of the Mount Pleasant Bluebirds basketball team. At 5'7", descended was an apt description. Just as the winds of change were blowing across the nation that year, the fortunes of that storied team were about to change as we entered the worst season in the annals of Bluebird basketball. Class B schools, the designation used in those days, without the population, resources, or desire to support a football team, were prevalent in rural north central Arkansas. Roundball had been preparing youth in the Ozark foothills for the game of life and teaching the virtues of discipline since the post-World War II era began. As in many rural areas of the state, basketball was king in Izard County. Although the county seat was and is still in Melbourne, the basketball capital was Mount Pleasant, home to those mighty Bluebirds. It seemed as though Mount Pleasant had always had winning seasons and most years dominated the likes of intra-county rivals Melbourne, Oxford, Violet Hill, and Calico Rock. In the fall of 1965 in Mount Pleasant, it was, as they say, a simpler time and place. Drugs were not a problem. Just say no is what mothers told their daughters before the first date. Social class was not an issue because everyone was working class. Ethnic groups were non-existent, unless one counted relatives visiting from California. Izard County, a dry county, meaning no legal alcohol sales, was surrounded by dry counties. It may not have been the buckle of the Bible Belt, but it was only a notch or two away. With a population of only 197, Mount Pleasant had five churches, including two kinds of Presbyterians. As in many small towns, the school's gymnasium was the largest building in town and second only to the pool hall as the cultural center. Basketball games and church services were as close as it got to formal affairs. Basketball coaches held celebrity status in the community and had the respect of their players. Our coach was also a nutrition expert and insisted that only a light snack be eaten early on the evening of a game day. Considered health food in those days, Hostess Twinkies were the favorite recommendation. In 1965, every player over 5'9" had graduated the previous May. Desperate for height, coach collared a good old boy who had never played and handed him a uniform. He was at least a six-footer and played like he had at least 6 feet. The poor fella tripped over paint stripes, but he looked good on the bench. A lack of height was not the only challenge to my masculinity. Being an unfashionably late arrival to the puberty ball, my chest was barren, and armpit hair was nearly invisible. My chagrin heightened when I got word that my scarcity of testosterone had been observed by a certain high school girl commenting on the lack of underarm hair. While tank-style jerseys cover most of the chest, it is impossible to play basketball without raising your arms. I tried. If only teams had been wearing t-shirts under their jersey in those days, another aspect of my adolescent inferiority complex could have been concealed. Had I known about steroids in those days, drugs might have been a problem in Mount Pleasant. Lacking offensive prowess, I became a defensive specialist, at least in my mind. My highlight of the season occurred in a game with the number one team in the district who had the big red-headed guy, destined for the college ranks. His movements soon became predictable as he would catch the ball and lower it to his waist before spinning toward the basket. The next time he lowered the ball, I simply grabbed it from his hands and will never forget that look on his face as he looked toward his coach. Although more than four decades have passed, I feel certain that even today he relives that painful recollection of the humiliation I inflicted upon him. Suffer, big guy. A winning season was hopeless, and it was apparent that no amount of coaching could overcome the lack of height and talent. With no shot clock in those days, there were many nights when we slowed the pace and humbled our opponents by keeping them in double figures. Coach recognized our plight early in the season and gave us permission to lose gracefully and still enjoy the game. We still got excited before every game and played for the love of basketball. And so it was, for the love of the game, that fateful night that I found myself alone in the paint, wide open, not a defender in sight. I caught the ball, dribbled for my manhood-saving layup. The adrenaline was pumping through my whole body, and time stood still as the ball left my hand. It bounced so hard off the glass, it hit behind the free throw line. Looking toward the bench, I saw Coach's hands cover his eyes, and from the corner of my eye, I detected a frozen smile of embarrassment on my girlfriend's face. A player from the other team grabbed the ball, passed it to an open teammate for an easy jump shot. The buzzer sounded, the game was over. Just as Arkansans thank God for Mississippi and so many economic statistics, Mount Pleasant gave thanks for a hapless and winless team from Norfolk that year. Both teams were winless, and Norfolk had the home court advantage. Yet the Bluebirds prevailed in the final game of the regular season, and we knew what it was like to have at least one victory. The town bemoaned the sorry state of Bluebird basketball, but dealt no cruelty to the current stewards. There were no calls for a coaching change, and nary a boo was ever directed at the players, for we were the home team, regardless of the record. I've heard there are benefits to be gained from every experience. Although the town had never experienced such depths of losing, perhaps it provided a greater appreciation for the winning seasons destined to return again. Accustomed to seeking benefits on a much lower plane than Shirley MacLaine, I am not too thrilled by the abstraction of being a martyr team providing salvation for the town's future gratitude. especially since the school fell victim to consolidation several years later, and now, sadly, Bluebird basketball is only a memory. As luck would have it, after graduation, I grew 4 inches taller and chest hair appeared. Okay, I only grew 2 inches, and the chest hair still leaves a little to be desired. Seriously, though, it did teach me persistence and determination in the face of superior odds. I gained a lifetime supply of humility and learned that just because you're a little short in some areas is never a reason not to play the game. The philosophically inclined and Visa commercials tell me an experience like this is priceless. I think about that Miss Layup and reply, make me an offer.
Gary Pittman lives in Little Rock and just retired this year as Chief Financial Officer at Central Arkansas Water. He is a graduate of Mount Pleasant High School and Arkansas State University. Next on Tales from the South, it's just Randy Romo and her brothers with no parental authority in Fireworks.
I grab my ears with each explosion, but I keep my face turned upward, eyes glued to the sky. I watch in eager anticipation as each new brilliant slash of color erupts across the dark, rich canvas of night. Fountains of brilliant red stars, pulsating rings of blue dots, and glittering green showers. My favorite is the one that screams straight up, rocketing tails of golden exhaust behind it, streaking up so high my neck hurts from watching. And just when it seems that it has left the atmosphere, lost forever, it reappears with a sonic boom, and a cloud of sparkling diamonds scatter across the sky. All the while, the shrieking whistle of bottle rockets and popping strings of black cat firecrackers punctuate the spaces between each big blast. The air is hot and heavy, trapping the smells of popcorn, roasted peanuts, french fries, and corn dogs. And in between the fireworks' acrid smell and all the fried food floats the pink-smelling sweetness of cotton candy. The crowd around me moves as one in sync with their heads craned skyward, and their unified oohs and ahs, a thrumming chorus. My brothers stand raptly next to me, heads tilted back, joining the choir. For once, we are not jostling, picking at, or arguing with one another. I feel a momentary sense of discomfort until I realize it's because I am absorbed in this crowd of people. And for just a second, we are all of a singular heartbeat. Just as quickly, the unease passes and joy ruffles every hair on my head as each new display arcs brilliantly skyward. The last of the fireworks fade into nothing, leaving the stars struggling to compensate in their wake, mere runner-ups to the beauty queen. The echoing booms fade into an eerie silence as the crowd lazily shakes itself awake, brushing off the magic of the pyrotechnics. They reclaim their individual voices, saying over and over again, "This year's fireworks sure were the best ever." Mothers begin the business of rounding up the kids, shaking out blankets and collecting picnic baskets. The men stand around in little clusters, drinking their last cold ones, talking sports, business, and maybe lawnmowers. A kid from each family is sent to retrieve their respective dads. They pull at the men's sleeves until the dads turn away and walk with their children to the parking lot. As we all pile into the family car, an old Rambler sedan, my brothers and I are like tightly coiled springs, still filled with the excitement of the evening. The three of us chatter away nonstop in the back seat, each of us exclaiming what we'd have done, how high we'd have made them fly, and the color combinations we'd have used if we were in charge of the fireworks. I think my brothers and I are all pyromaniacs at heart. We are enthralled by anything to do with fire, and the fact that fire could be used to make such beautiful aerial explosions, even better. The pure delight of the moment fills every nook and cranny around us, and we cling to it, wringing every drop of joy from the experience. And then comes Mom's steely voice to stop talking and to be still. Like an exhale sigh, the happiness begins to slip out of the car, disappearing into the nighttime rushing past the open windows. In the quiet, my thoughts turn back to the night before. A group of neighborhood kids gathered in the road just up from our house. Piled up on the sidewalk were enough fireworks to stock a small stand. A couple of dads supervise the fire source as the kids begin setting off bottle rockets, sparklers, fountain showers, Roman candles, firecrackers, cherry bombs, and smoke bombs, and the constant screeching, banging, and popping, along with a few pretty good booms. And some of them even go up into the air with colorful showers of sparks. The kids scamper around, shrilly proclaiming that the next one will be the best, shouting, "Let me, it's my turn now." Someone's mom comes out and admonishes her child, "Don't hold those firecrackers in your hand, you'll blow your fingers off." The kid's dad gets in on it too. "Edith, he's fine, I'm watching him. We don't know anyone who's blown their hand off playing with a few little firecrackers. Let him alone." The kid's mom says something else, but her words are lost in the cacophony of more firecrackers and bottle rockets going off at the same time. Mom doesn't allow my brothers and me to leave our yard, and we rarely are given permission to go and play with the other kids. So there we stand, toes gripping the boundary line of the sidewalk, leaning out as far as we can to try and see everything going on in the street. Our excitement at seeing the fireworks just barely eclipses our jealousy at not being able to join in. And then it's over. The kids drift off to their various houses, parents in tow, until all that's left on the street are remnants of burnt paper and other debris under the streetlight's glow. My brothers and I stand there a little longer talking about how many fireworks we will buy when we are old enough, each of us trying hard to top the other. The next morning is Saturday, and I am ecstatic because Mom and Dad are spending the day running errands. And better yet, they are leaving my brothers and me at home, which is almost as great as the fireworks. Mom rarely allows us to watch television, so I immediately begin plotting the day's viewing lineup. We'll watch cartoons in the morning for the boys, and then it will be my turn. And even though I don't get to watch it often, I love Saturday afternoon television the most. There's always a Hercules movie and then shock theater with movies about mummies, vampires, and other creatures. So there I was, propped up on the couch with a giant bowl of popcorn and deeply engrossed in The Mummy's Curse, when suddenly the front door slams open and my little brother Jimmy comes running into the living room. He jumps on the couch, spilling popcorn everywhere in his excitement, exclaiming, "I can't get them to light. They won't light. I found a whole box of fireworks and none of them will light. You gotta help me." With the words "a whole box of fireworks," I stop yelling at him about spilling the popcorn and interrupting my movie. "Fireworks," I say. "Where did you find fireworks? Show me." I grab him by the hand and he leads me outside. He says, "I found them in Mama's drawer." I stop short. This can only mean a big bucket load of trouble. But just as quick, I don't care. I love fireworks as much as Jimmy does, maybe more. And all I can think about is lighting them up. Jimmy leads me to the side yard, and the sight of his fireworks fills me with mixed emotions. First laughter, then deep disappointment, and finally, "Oh, wow, Mom is so gonna kill you for this." He has laid them out in perfect rows like a miniature missile field, the contents of an entire box of tampons. He's planted the ends of the applicators in the sand so that the strings all hang from the top. A few of them are scorched on the ends from his efforts to light them. Spent kitchen matches are strewn about, and the white paper wrappers slowly flutter across the yard like bored flagmen directing traffic to nowhere in particular. Before I can say anything, he runs over to the porch and comes back with the matches. "Can you get them to light?" He shoves the matches at me while hopping from foot to foot in anticipation. And it is only by the grace of having just had the talk with my mom a few weeks before that I know what they are. And I turn to Jimmy and I say, "These aren't fireworks." His face falls and his disappointment mirrors my own. But there's no time for lingering in our sorrow. I tell him, "We got to get this cleaned up before Mom comes home. She's going to be really mad if she sees this." "Well, if they aren't fireworks, then what are they?" he says. Now the laughter wins out as I look again at his efforts. Choking it back, I tell him, "These are Mom things, and she'll be really upset if she comes home and sees them all over the yard like this. So let's get this cleaned up." He looks up at me so seriously, and he says, "Are you sure they aren't fireworks?" "I'm sure," I tell him. Now let's get this cleaned up and hide everything in the trash. The car hits a bump, and Jimmy falls against me. Putting his hand in mine, he whispers, "Tonight's fireworks sure were way better than mine, weren't they?" And I smile in the dark, and I whisper back to him, "Yeah, they were. But yours looked really cool the way you had them set up." I can hear the sleepiness in his voice as he says, "I'm going to get some real ones one day, and I'm going to set them all up and blow them as high as the moon." He leans in closer, snuggling into my side, and still holding my hand, he falls asleep.
Randy M. Romo is a human being with a multiplicity of identities, including Mexican-American, queer, daughter, parent, grandparent, writer, artist, activist, and adventurer. Originally from Texas, she now lives in Little Rock. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Michael Hilden is solo, but unfortunately not for long, in I Got a Bite.
I hadn't said a word in about 30 minutes. The cicadas were loud enough. The only light visible was from a half moon. It was plenty for what we were doing, two high school buddies fishing. Sitting on an overturned bucket, all I could see across the creek was blackness. I knew there were trees there, but I couldn't make them out across the slow-moving overflow of Lake Levan. The trees gave way as you looked up to the dim glow of the moon reflecting the sun's light onto the northeast Texas forest. The sun seemed to want to wickedly remind you that its rays were always there. The heat of the day simply became the heat of the night, July in Texas. 110-degree afternoons meant 99-degree nights. And it was humid. Sweat would form on the body almost immediately upon exiting the truck. My friend Adam had left me alone for the moment as he hiked to the truck for a lighter so we could start a fire to attempt to keep the mosquitoes away. Even in this heat, a fire would be welcome relief from the bloodsuckers. My line was wet. I was using a bobber as I had been taught as a young fisherman on Lake Cypress Springs. We were trying to catch catfish, which meant we had gone to the bait store and asked for the nastiest smelling crap you got. The store was the type of place that had everything you could ever need: beer, bait, and ammo. The wall was adorned with a rebel flag. The man working the register never seemed to mind. He also didn't mind asking for our ID when we purchased the champagne of beers, Miller High Life. If he wasn't working, we would just wait outside and pull what we had dubbed a "Hey, Mister." The conversation would go something like, "Hey, Mister, would you mind picking up a 12-pack for me and my friends here?" We'd get a quizzical look sometimes, but if we had chosen our accomplice properly, the next sentence would be, "Sure thing, young buck. What you drinking?" "Anything cold and wet, you know, the beer-flavored beer," would be the response. Then my bobber went under. I set the hook and knew immediately that I had something a little larger than a minnow, perhaps. I reeled in my catch, a catfish maybe 6 inches long, certainly nothing to be proud of or even to eat. Still, I wanted to keep it on the line before throwing it back just to show Adam that we had caught something and that the night wasn't a complete bust. I held the fish on the line just at the top of the water level and gave it a little slack so it could swim around a bit. I reached for the cooler and grabbed another beer. I looked down to open it. When I looked back up, I saw a silhouette moving across the surface of the water. I grew up in suburban Dallas, Plano to be exact, Far East Plano to be precise, the type of place that had been farmland not 5 minutes before the developers came in. Hundreds of acres parceled out overnight into quarter-acre plots. Homes put up, schools erected, it was safe. The type of neighborhood where a young boy could ride around on his 10-speed in a Speedo to the country club without a parent needing to worry. So the idea that I was some country boy would be a stretch, an exaggeration to say the least. I went to an all-boys Catholic school where we wore suits every day. Adam and I were not the Duke boys, but we sure wanted to think we were. We were impressionable youths when Bush II was elected, or as we called him, W. We flocked to all things Texas. There was nothing but highways and high-rises between my house and the 19 miles I traveled to high school, but I insisted on a four-wheel drive truck. I had never ridden a bull, but I had numerous shiny belt buckles. I had braces, but thought I could dip Copenhagen snuff like Robert O. Keane. And actually, I only tried that once and puked all night. But on the weekend, I would don my 28-inch waistband Wranglers and slap on a cowboy hat and would head out to the backside of the Lavon Dam. My uncle laughed at me when I discovered this new cowboy persona. He not so affectionately called me Woody. I was all of 125 pounds when I graduated high school. And so there I sat, the silhouette moving closer across the surface of the water, leaving a slight wake behind it on the near motionless creek. There was no question what I was looking at. The creature is universally recognizable. It is the first animal besides man to play a prominent role in the Bible. It's feared by some, respected by others, exalted by many, and worshiped by ancient and contemporary cultures alike. In the near perfect darkness, it was clear a 5-foot snake was making its way towards my prized fish. I wasn't sure what to do. Even though I was a suburban kid, I knew a water moccasin when I saw one. A quick Google search will tell you that the scientific name for the water moccasin, or cottonmouth as it is known in some parts of the South, is Agistrodon piscivorus, which all will be very surprised to learn means hook-toothed fish eater. The bite has been described by one victim as lighting my leg on fire and poking it with an electric fork. So here I had a fish on a string and a hook-toothed fish eater machine of death headed right for it. I lifted the fish out of the water. Then I realized as I brought my pole vertical that the fish was going to swing in towards me. I quickly decided I did not want to tempt hook-toothed fish eater into becoming hook-toothed leg biter or man eater. We were about a mile from the truck, and getting back sans one leg would be quite difficult. Plus, for the moment at least, I was alone, except for my two animal friends, of course. But let's just say they were not getting along swimmingly. I had the poor fish dangling about 6 inches above the water at the end of my 7-foot pole. Questions one does not often have the chance to ponder rush through my head. Can a snake jump? Can a snake jump out of the water? Is a fish suspended in midair the type of fish a hook-toothed fish eater prefers? I soon had answers. The moccasin circled underneath my fish, coiled up, and paused for what I am sure was only a second or two, but felt like an hour. In that moment, all was still. The fish wasn't moving. The snake was coiled with its head slightly above the rest of its body. And I was frozen solid in the heat of the night. And then it struck. I could actually hear it. There was an audible thud of flesh striking flesh. It was like lightning. Bam! The fish started to squirm for its life on the end of the wheel. I could feel the violence of the act in my fingers, up my arms and shoulders, and in my core. At that moment, there was literally a direct line connecting me to the snake. The snake thrashed like a mad dog attacks a coon. Not because the coon did anything to the dog, because it's in its nature. And I mean a real dog, not your fluffy city dog. Something that hasn't been dulled by the everyday monotony of human city life. The snake continued to be troubled by the fact that his dinner was not swimming away with him. The fish had gone completely limp within a minute of the attack. The snake was trying to take its prize home. The same silhouette that was coming towards me not minutes before was now facing away. It was oddly peaceful. The undulations of the snake cast small ripples across the water, blurring the reflection of the moon and stars. I sat there transfixed. Eventually, the snake gave up, removed its teeth from the fish, and swam away. The fish was dead on my line. Adam showed up minutes later. I said, "Dude, you're not going to believe what happened." He looked at my line and he said, "How on earth did you catch a dead fish?" The only response I could muster was, "I got a bite."
Michael Hilden is a third-year student at the UALR Bowen School of Law. He has two children, Charlotte 3 and Marshall 1. His wife, Jill, is his biggest fan and his best friend. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you. to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center. And thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers' Colony at Dairy Hollow, ULR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Here I stand behind this microphone, and I start to sing another country song. They say play that one about a love that's gone wrong. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Round and round where they stop, I don't know. Another smoke-filled country bar, another show. Trying to find a friend in a crowd of I don't know. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.